Hello and welcome to our accredited presentation entitled The Role of the ED in Treating Multiple Myeloma in the Era of Novel Immunotherapies. Today's program is provided by Medicom Worldwide, Inc. and is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Joshua Richter, Associate Professor of Medicine, Tisch Cancer Institute, Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, Director of Myeloma, Blavatnik Family Chelsea Medical Center at Mount Sinai in New York, New York. Dr. Richter, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. And one of the best parts about that title is listening to people's struggles to say, Blavatnik, you actually did amazing. But I do apologize for that. Well, thank you, everyone, for tuning in today, both live and virtual. Apologies that I'm not there. I did my undergrad in Baltimore, and I'm a big fan of the city. Today, we're going to be talking about the role of the emergency department in treating multiple myeloma in the era of novel immunotherapies, a really exciting topic. And this was developed in a concert with a number of amazing physicians, including one of my colleagues, Dr. Larissa Sanchez, and perhaps the greatest emergency room doctor I've ever met, Dr. Monica Watana. Here are our disclosures. We have a number of them. They are all listed below. Our learning objectives. We're going to be discussing the latest and greatest in myeloma therapy. And really, when we talk about the latest and greatest, we're talking about the immune therapies, the T-cell redirection therapies, basically bispecific antibodies and CAR T-cell therapies. And although these drugs have brought with them some of the greatest response rates, most durable remission rates we've ever seen in myeloma, they come with them a variety of novel adverse events. And the reality is these patients are going to be showing up in our emergency departments, and special considerations need to be taken and more collaboration now than ever between our emergency room colleagues and our hem-onc colleagues. So really discussing some of the nitty-gritty with particular focus on some of the main immune-related adverse events, such as cytokine release syndrome or CRS, and the immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome, or ICONS. So let's dive right in and talk about some of the basics overview of myeloma. So myeloma is considered the second most common cancer of the blood. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is number one, but let's be honest, they cheat. They have all these different types. Diffuse large B, mantle cell, marginal zone, follicular. Myeloma is number one, but for the purposes of this discussion, we'll call it number two. It's about 1.8% of all cancer diagnoses in the US, about 10% of all blood cancers. The average age is 69 years. It does increase in frequency with advancing age. And over the last several decades, we have seen phenomenal improvements in progression-free and overall survival. If we date back to the 1970s and 80s, the median overall survival, all comers from diagnosis to death, was about 2 years. Now we can see here in some of the most recent SEER data, the five-year survival rate from patients diagnosed between 2013 and 2019 is almost 60%. So we have many patients having overall survivals of greater than a decade being diagnosed in the modern era. Now, when we find monoclonal gammopathies or an M spike in the blood, it's not always myeloma. There are a variety of other conditions we can consider, including more benign ones like MGUS, the monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. But when myeloma does evolve to require therapy, the common symptoms fall under the acronym CRAB. And the CRAB symptoms are what we've been talking about for decades. So C for high calcium levels. And when the calcium levels go up, you can have kidney issues. You can have confusion or pain. R for renal, another word for kidney. The kidney's like a filter for the blood. And when you have too much bad protein floating around, clogs up the filter, you can have kidney dysfunction. A for anemia. We normally have red blood cells made in our bone marrow, but if you have a malignant process inside that's growing and growing, it's going to crowd out the healthy cells and your blood counts will drop and you can get anemia. And yeah, B for bone lesions. You can get the lytic lesions or holes in the bones from increased osteoclast activity. And ultimately, besides pain, these patients can present with fractures. What's really important to note is that 10 to 20% of all myeloma patients are diagnosed with no symptoms. common presentation is a patient goes into their PCP for yearly blood work. It shows an elevation in their total protein. They undergo further workup, sent to a hematologist oncologist, and are diagnosed with an incurable malignancy with not a single symptom. So in 2024, we've evolved our understanding of both diagnostics and therapeutics in the cancer world. And we know tons about genomics and proteomics and immunologics, but really we define a cancer, we define a malignancy based on what cell became malignant. A lung cell becomes malignant, that's lung cancer. A skin cell becomes malignant, that's melanoma. Myeloma is a malignancy of plasma cells. And plasma cells are immune cells that make antibodies to fight infection. And normally when we talk about the differentiation of hematopoietic cells, we start with a stem cell, which gives rise to B lymphocytes. And plasma cells are simply terminally differentiated B lymphocytes. And when they become rogue or malignant, they start, instead of making healthy antibodies, they make misfolded proteins, and that's that M protein. So when we want to look for proteins, normal or abnormal, we use a serum protein electrophoresis. Really cool technology where we basically take the patient's plasma, put it on an electrophoretic plate, and zap it with some electricity. And when we zap it, we actually see the proteins kind of elute out based from heaviest to lightest in different zones. And basically all the proteins in the body are either albumin or globulins. And globulins come as alpha 1, alpha 2, beta, and gamma. Gamma is where the antibodies live. And normally this should be polyclonal. You should have all different types of plasma cells making different antibodies to fight the flu, COVID, syphilis, whatever. And that's what we see in normal circumstance. We call this polyclonal. You can see that gamma region is low and humped. But what happens when we find a monoclonal gammopathy? Excuse me. We go through the same process. We put the patient's plasma on the electrophoretic plate. We zap it. And now when we see the proteins elute out, albumin, alpha, and beta are typically normal. But in the gamma zone, we see a monoclonal spike, a group of protein that really all comes from the same cell, not from different cells, not polyclonal meaning many, but monoclonal meaning one, because the cells are all related to one another. And ultimately, this looks like a big spike, or that M spike, used to be called positive cathedral sign. And this shows us that the bad protein is being made by the malignant plasma cells. Now, we associate this with the amount of plasma cells, and this is how we monitor the disease, where we find someone with one of these disorders. We administer some type of treatment, which kills the bad cells in the marrow, leading to a lower amount of protein in the blood. Now, the Krebs symptoms have been the standard of care for many years, although we now have begun to understand that people with earlier disorders, more benign versions like MGUS or smoldering myeloma. Smoldering myeloma is where you have the myeloma protein and you have the bad cells, but no symptoms, no Krebs symptoms. And standard procedure was to monitor these patients without treatment. Excuse me. However, we now recognize that there are certain predictors that patients may have that even though they don't have symptoms, we ought to consider treating them. So we like to say that the crab has gone on a diet, and now we call it the slim crab criteria. So if you have either more than 3 grams of the bad protein in the blood or more than 10% of the bad cells in the marrow, and you have no crab, we used to not treat you. But now if you have S for 60, so more than 60% plasma cells in the bone marrow, LI for light chain ratio, so a capital lambda or a lambda to kappa serum ratio of greater than 100 to 1, or B for bone lesion. We used to talk about bone lesions on x-rays, Roentgenograms, but now if you have greater than one lesion of at least 5 millimeters seen on an MRI, we consider treating you. So ultimately, we don't have to treat patients with the SLIM criteria, but we have the option to some of those people that may be borderline and may truly warrant therapy. So what are the current treatment guidelines? So even though the specific drugs that we use have not changed have changed dramatically across the years, the general scheme of how we approach newly diagnosed myeloma has not. So in general, when we diagnose patients as needing treatment, we term them transplant eligible or transplant ineligible. Here, the term transplant refers to an autologous stem cell transplant. Now, it's not an allogeneic transplant. It's simply administering a high dose of melphalan, which kills both healthy and abnormal cells, but rescuing the bone marrow with autologous previously collected peripheral blood stem cells. Now, there are no hard and fast guidelines in the United States of who is transplant eligible and who is transplant ineligible. Suffice to say that other countries have guidelines. In the US, we refer to the eligible patients as the younger and fitter group, with the ineligible patients being older and frailer. But again, a lot of this is in the eye of the beholder. Either way, all patients receive some type of induction therapy. The transplant eligible patients will receive high dose chemotherapy with autologous stem cell rescue. All patients tend to go on some type of long-term maintenance therapy, but ultimately, regardless of which drugs you use, transplant or not, two drugs, three drugs, four drugs, fancy drugs, old drugs, everyone really ends up in the bucket of relapse and refractory disease. And this is the current landscape that we look at for the relapse refractory world. And we have a lot of different drugs at our disposal. We start off with the classical IMiD drugs, the immunomodulatory drugs. These are all derivatives of thalidomide. So for those of you that remember thalidomide from the 1950s and 60s, that was used to help pregnant women with morning sickness and sleep because it didn't suppress respiratory centers like the barbiturates would. Unfortunately, it caused deformities in the limbs through a variety of mechanisms, including inhibition of vascular endothelial growth factor. It turns out that those classes of agents actually have significant anti-myeloma activity, not just through inhibition of VEGF within the marrow space, but additionally through propagating pro-apoptotic mechanisms, but mostly they modulate NKT cells, so that's why they're called IMiDs. We have thalidomide, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide. We now have the proteasome inhibitors. Remember that the proteasome ubiquitin pathway is really the garbage disposal system of cells, and because myeloma cells make tons of that M protein, that tons of garbage, they're really targeted to myeloma cells. We have classical chemo drugs that we've used across a variety of tumor types, including anthracyclines and alkylators. Steroids have become a mainstay of most of our therapies. And now on the right, we have some of our newer, cooler medicines, including these monoclonal antibody drugs like elotuzumab, daratumumab, and isatuximab, as well as our SINE, our selective inhibitor of nuclear export, selinexor. But really what we're going to focus on today are the left two columns, where we've moved on from classical chemotherapy to some of the newer drugs, and now on to the T-cell redirection, where the goal is not just to kill all the good and the bad, but really to push up the good cells to attack the bad. And we really have two modalities, the CAR T-cell, CAR T standing for chimeric antigen receptor T-cells. And at the time of this recording, we have two FDA-approved ones, IDACEL and CILTACEL, and the off-the-shelf bispecific antibodies. At the time of this recording, we have three FDA-approved ones, teclistamab, elranatamab, and talquetamab. Now, in terms of how we approach myeloma, in terms of the general therapy, here we can see the NCCN guidelines. And for the most part, our initial therapy is really where we distinguish transplant eligible from ineligible. Once patients end up in the relapse refractory setting, we don't distinguish one from the other. Again, we may want to reserve certain drugs for fitter patients, but overall, there's no purely accepted schema. For patients who are transplant eligible, in general, we tend to use either three or four drug regimens, with some of the more common regimens, including bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, plus or minus the addition of the monoclonal antibody daratumumab. When it comes to non-transplant eligible, the two most common regimens are listed at the top, bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, or daratumumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, both extremely efficacious regimens, high response rates, and very durable. When it comes to relapse refractory myeloma, we really refer to the relapse space as either being early relapse or late relapse. Early relapse is 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. Late relapse is 4 or more prior lines of therapy. Now, there are no clear guidelines about what drug to use in what circumstance. In myeloma, we talk about three modalities of picking a therapy: disease-related factors, patient-related factors, and treatment-related factors. So patient-related, is the patient old or young, fit or frail? What comorbidities do they have? Disease-related factors, is the disease growing fast or slow? Is there extramedullary disease, bad cytogenetics, functionally high risk? But ultimately, one of the first passes we use is treatment-related factors. What drugs have they had before? What have they not had before? So What are they naive to? What are they refractory to? What are they sensitive to? And the NCCN guideline follows this by dividing patients into being bortezomib refractory or lenalidomide refractory. And in the United States and in many other countries, the majority of people in early relapse are lenalidomide refractory. So we're mostly looking at a lot of our regimens that include the CD38 targeting monoclonal antibodies like daratumumab and isatuximab. We have a laundry list of other options to use, which includes some of our old drugs and some of our new drugs, and even some selected out regimens for patients with an 1114 translocation. We use a drug called venetoclax. But what we're most interested in is currently the late line of therapy. And for patients who have four or more lines, we really have a few groups of options. One group is some of the novel agents like selinexor or belantamab. At the time of this recording, belantamab had been taken off the FDA market given the negative results of the DREAM-3 study. However, the DREAM-7 and DREAM-8 study are positive, so we're likely to see that drug come back in the fray. Otherwise, a lot of our therapies include classical chemo, drugs like bendamustine and cyclophosphamide. But really what we're looking towards now in later relapse is utilizing T-cell redirection therapy. And as you can see at the top, we have listed our CAR-Ts and bispecific antibodies. So let's talk about what happens as we go through this course. And essentially, as you go from relapse 1 to relapse 2 to relapse 3, we recognize that the likelihood of getting a deep and durable remission goes down. And patients become more and more refractory. Although one thing that is starting to change this is that our T-cell redirection therapies are so efficacious, we have patients who have had 19 lines of therapy and then get one of these, and that can be much more durable. But we recognize that the classic three types of treatments we've been using in the last decade, the IMiDs, the proteasome inhibitors, and the monoclonal antibodies, we're using them in more and more combinations earlier on. So I remember a time where these were given in what we call sequential doublets. Revlimid and dexamethasone, then Pomalyst and dexamethasone, then Velcade and dexamethasone, carfilzomib, dexamethasone, and Dara and dexamethasone. It would take five lines of therapy to be what we call triple class refractory. Refractory to an immunomodulatory drug like Revlimid, a proteasome inhibitor like Velcade, and a monoclonal antibody like daratumumab. But nowadays, we're using regimens like Dara-RVD up front. And if you progress on that, you can be triple class refractory going in to your second line. So we really need to go beyond those three core classes of drugs, the IMiDs, the proteasome inhibitors, and the monoclonals. And I know this is a lot of setup, but really what this is taking us to is we're seeing some of the best response rates, even in heavily refractory patients, with the drugs on the right, the drugs that target T cells for activation, either through engaging with one of the targets like BCMA, or GPRC5D, or FCRH5. So let's start off with BCMA, because BCMA, also known as B-cell maturation antigen, has become one of the most key targets of T-cell redirection therapy. BCMA is widely expressed on plasma cells, specifically malignant plasma cells, just like you may be familiar with the other CDs, like Rituxan is an anti-CD20 antibody, and daratumumab is an anti-CD38 antibody. BCMA is CD269. Now, we cannot use naked antibodies here like we can with other targets. We have to use some other technology, either an antibody drug conjugate like belantamab mafodotin, where the naked antibody has a warhead, the naked antibody engages with any BCMA expressing tumor cell and then injects the poison. Think about it like classical chemo, but instead of a systemic infusion, it's directly delivered to the malignant cell. Again, we only have one of these drugs that's currently off the market. Hopefully we'll come back in the near future. But the two main ways we've been exploiting BCMA is either through the use of CAR T-cell therapies, and we have a number of them under investigation, or through bispecific antibodies. And bispecific antibodies utilize a two-arm structure where one arm grabs onto the BCMA-expressing malignant cell, the other arm grabs onto the CD3-expressing T-cell and activates the T-cell to attack the myeloma cell. And with bispecific antibodies, we've gone beyond just utilizing BCMA as a target, where although we have two currently approved BCMA bispecific antibodies, elranatamab and teclistamab, in the bispecific world, we moved on to additional targets such as GPRC5D, another target that's ubiquitously expressed on plasma cells, specifically malignant plasma cells. Right now, we have the FDA-approved bispecific talquetamab with another bispecific for him to make under active investigation. And FCRH5, another target that's expressed widely and independently on myeloma cells, and this is under investigation with the bispecific antibody cevostamab. But ultimately, when we're talking about bispecific antibodies, we group them into the BCMA types and the non-BCMA types. Now, just to put this into context of how great some of these drugs are, if you look across the last 10 to 15 years of FDA approvals for myeloma, in general, when a new drug comes to market that's given at the end of the line, either by itself or with a little bit of steroid, the response rates have varied between 22 and 30% and have achieved FDA approval. So pomalidomide, carfilzomib, daratumumab, belantamab, or even selinexor, all of these drugs that have been approved, response rates between 22 and 30% and a progression-free survival around 6 months, all approved by the FDA. Now, if you look at all of the BCMA bispecifics, you'll see response rates ranging between 60 and 80% with progression-free survivals in some of these trials of well over a year and some even quite a bit longer. Now, again, at the time of this recording, if we look at the top, elranatamab and teclistamab are FDA approved. Linvoseltamab has had its BLA accepted by the European Medical Association and the FDA, currently under review, hoping for approval later this year. When it comes to the non-BCMA bispecifics, talquetamab and cevostamab on the right, again, we're seeing response rates of between 60 and 80%, very durable. But again, these are coming with them a whole new set of toxicities. So really, this is the meat of this is really talking about what are the new adverse events that we see with these type of therapies. Now, in my mind, there are early toxicities and late toxicities. The early ones are adverse events that tend to occur during the step-up period. So for bispecific antibodies, as opposed to CAR Ts, where CAR Ts, we give the entire dose, cellular dose at one time. For bispecifics, instead of giving the full dose, we ramp it up slowly so that we don't overwhelm the immune system. Because the immune system, we always want like Goldilocks. We don't want it too cold where it's not fighting the myeloma. We don't want it too hot where it's going haywire. We want it in the Goldilocks zone. When it gets overactivated, that's what we call CRS or cytokine release syndrome. And that can even lead to things like ICANS, the immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome. These adverse events tend to occur early on during that initial step-up period, which usually lasts around a week. You can get some lowered blood counts during this time, so cytopenias are common. However, the use of white cell growth factors like filgrastim, Neupogen, Branex can actually exacerbate the risk of CRS early on. So if you're concerned about CRS and the patient presents to the emergency room and they're neutropenic, you may want to hesitate before giving G-CSF so that you don't exacerbate this. Infections can occur early on, but a lot of this occurs a little bit later on once the drug has had a chance to deplete a lot of the immune-producing cells. So when it comes to the GPRC5D bispecific antibodies, there are talquetamab and forimtamig. And one of the things that's really important to note is that the GPRC5D as a target is very different from BCMA. So BCMA that we've talked a little bit about, CD269, is really only expressed on immune-related cells, specifically plasma cells and a little bit on B cells as well. There's not a lot of off-target expression. GPRC5D is located more on malignant plasma cells. It's actually less expressed on B cells. It's not really even expressed on B cells, but it's located on the squamous epithelium of the hands and feet, and people can get a desquamating rash that kind of reminds me of Xeloda. So you get this desquamating peeling rash. It's also located on the oropharynx and salivary glands, so people can get dry mouth, dysgeusia, and even trouble swallowing and anorexia and weight loss. So it can be a little more difficult to tolerate. Here are some of the non-hematologic toxicities of talquetamab. And again, on the right, you can see the injection site reactions, but really what we see is thinning of the nails, diffuse macular papular body rashes, and this desquamating palmar plantar rash that we can see on the left on the hands and feet. When it comes to CAR T, this is kind of the mainstay of what we talk about when we're talking about immunotherapy. Sorry. And essentially, this really comes from the concept of the best cancer fighter is our own immune system. And although bispecifics are off the shelf, they're really just using the T cells laying around. The goal here is first we ferret or collect the T cells of a patient. And then in the lab, we engineer them and expand them. So now we have a huge group of T cells that are all targeting BCMA. So it's like taking some first day army recruits, sending them off to special training, you know, getting a whole bunch of them together and then giving them bazookas and sending them back in the fight. That manufacturing process can take up to 4 to 8 weeks at the current time. There are ongoing studies to shrink that. During that time, we want to make sure that the patient's disease doesn't cause them any trouble. So we typically give them what we call bridging therapy, basically chemotherapy designed to hold the myeloma at bay while we manufacture the CAR T product. When it's ready to go, we can't just infuse that product because right now we all have T cell repertoires, T cells to fight bacteria, viruses, a whole variety of diseases. If we only infuse the CAR T now, it's just a voice amongst the crowd. We need to create immunologic space. We do this by first giving what we call lymphodepleting chemotherapy, 3 days of a combination of fludarabine and cyclophosphamide, neither of which is designed to kill the myeloma, but basically to turn the patient into an AIDS patient and eradicate their endogenous T cells so that when we infuse the CAR T, it is the dominant T cell force in their body. How this works, we take a T cell, use viral DNA to insert this and express and basically target that BCMA. When they get infused, they latch on to the tumor cells and they release granzymes and porphyrins to kill the tumor cells. And essentially, this is how CAR T works. Now, we have a bunch of them in clinical trial. The two on the left are the currently approved ones, Ide-cel and Cilta-cel. But there's ongoing studies to look at developing them at academic centers, rapid manufacturing, dual targeting, alternative targeting, and even allo CARs, off-the-shelf allogeneic CAR Ts that won't need to be manufactured at the time from the patients themselves. So you don't have to worry about that manufacturing time. But you still have to kind of worry a little bit about graft versus host disease. So what happens when we infuse those CAR Ts into you? And essentially, we infuse the CAR T cells. The T cells expand, they engage with tumor cells. And one of the biggest things that we get is not only T cell activation and T cell expansion, but we get broad-based immune responses with heavy release of a variety of chemokines and cytokines, specifically things like interleukin-1, interleukin-6, TNF-alpha, TGF-beta, and we can get a variety of sequelae from this. Now, one of the things to note is that when we undergo either bispecific antibodies or CAR T cells, we are inducing a broad range of immune suppression. And this is multifactorial. So number one, we're giving drugs that kill immune-producing cells. So we kill some bad plasma cells, but we kill some good ones and oftentimes some good lymphocytes. So we lose part of our humoral immunity, inability to produce antibodies, or what we call hypogammaglobulinemia. In addition, we also have cytopenias, and neutropenia is not uncommon in this. The other one is a little weird to think of, but T cell redirection means you have T cells that were designed to fight bacteria, viruses, and cancer, and you're either eradicating them with a CAR T and then giving another T cell back, that CAR T, or in bispecific antibodies, you're grabbing them and say, don't fight the bacteria and the viruses, come here to fight the cancer, in which case nobody's minding the shot. Infection-wise, we see some of the highest rates of infection we've ever seen, with drugs like teclistamab showing an overall infection rate of around 76%, with almost half of those infections being grade 3 or higher. The way we overcome this is mostly through the use of both antibiotic and antiviral prophylaxis, but judicious use of IVIG, intravenous immune globulin. With CAR T, the immune dysfunction is still multifaceted, where you get a combination of cytopenias and humoral deficiency from the lymphodepletion, but the neutropenia and the immunosuppression can last for quite a bit of time. So initially, during that step-up period or during the initial post-infusion CAR T period, we're seeing mostly bacterial infections, oral candidiasis, but as we go on, we tend to see a little more viral and even PJP reactivation. When it comes to patients with infection patterns, again, the majority of infections we're going to see post-CAR T. So if someone comes in with a fever and they've had a prior CAR T therapy, again, really depends upon where they're coming in, you know, 1 week out, 1 month out, 6 months out. But most of the infections are upper respiratory, and some lower respiratory, but really respiratory infections. Remembering that the very large amount of immune cell burden is located within the pulmonary vasculature. So when we wipe that out, we really put patients at risk for URIs. And we can see that here. We do see a variety of viral reactivation. So patients who do have fevers that are far out, we do worry about things like CMV and EBV reactivation. And given the fact that, remember, I mentioned we're giving lymphodepletion chemotherapy to essentially wipe out T cells and turn these patients into AIDS patients, we're seeing rises in pneumocystis pneumonia. So our general scheme is to provide pneumocystis prophylaxis until the CD4 count goes back up above 200. But if you do see a patient in the ER with a PJP-like pattern, an LDH rising, it's worthwhile to think about PJP pneumonia. So the big thing we wanna focus on is a raising awareness of the immune-related adverse events. And again, we talked about the main ones, CRS and ICONS, although there's a few others, including HLH, which we'll talk about. And one of the things that, you know, when we talk about CRS and ICONS is that you can have CRS without ICONS, you can have ICONS without CRS, or what is the more common pathway is that CRS comes on and then ICONS, if it's going to show up, follows. Oftentimes, we're able to treat the CRS before we ever get ICONS, so CRS is far more common, but how they occur and if they occur independently of one another helps dictate how we manage this in the clinic or in the emergency room. So cytokine release syndrome is simply this. It's a syndrome, a constellation of circumstances that leads to things like fever, hypoxia, tachycardia, hypotension. What does that sound like? Well, that sounds to me a whole lot like sepsis. And one of the big ways that we help differentiate between the two is timing. If I give you a bispecific antibody in the morning and at noon you have fever, that is CRS. If I gave you a CAR T in January and in August you have a fever, that is infection. It's the middle ground, a week into it. That's where you may not know if this is CRS or infection, and that's where sometimes you have to treat both at the same time. And one of the things, if I leave you with anything, is I approach CRS in a lot of these scenarios in a similar vein to how we approach COPD, right? You have someone who presents to your ER with a COPD exacerbation, you oftentimes give them steroids and antibiotics. And there's nothing wrong if you are unsure about where you are with these constellation of symptoms to give some steroid and antibiotics, follow up cultures the next day after they're admitted, and then adjust therapy as indicated. And again, we have a CRS grading that starts with things as limited as fever, but progress all the way to ICU requirement. And again, we look at the ASBMT CRS grading. In many institutions, we treat CRS only when it gets to grade one. Some institutions wait till grade two, but we certainly want to prevent grade three or grade four. How do we treat it? Well, if you have grade one, either prolonged grade one or grade two, we typically treat as a first-line therapy with a drug called tocilizumab. Tocilizumab is an anti-IL-6 therapy. Another one is cetuximab, but tocilizumab or TOCI is usually our first go-around. Now, you may not have this in your emergency department. This drug is not always available. If you do not have this drug available and you think the patient may have CRS, we typically give steroids, most notably dexamethasone because of its potency, its half-life, and the penetrance into the CNS. And the dose is 10 milligrams. Now, in some cases, we dose as frequently as 10 IVQ6. But I think if someone had a bispecific antibody last week and presents to your ER with fever, tachycardia, and hypoxia, I see no problem with giving dexamethasone 10 milligrams of IV, drawing cultures, giving antibiotics, and then reevaluating the patient's response. Again, you may want to avoid G-CSF during the step-up period, but if they're outside of the step-up period and you really don't think it's CRS, you can consider giving it, but I would proceed with caution there. As we progress, if you've given tocilizumab and you've given steroids, the Dex-10 IV, and the patient you feel is still having CRS symptoms, so someone with fever without localizing symptoms, or now it's a little bit later in the ER and you swab them and all the viral cultures are negative, maybe you sent a procalcitonin and the procal is negative and you're not thinking that infection and the UA is negative and the chest x-ray is negative, and the patient is developing gradual worsening of CRS, you can crank up the treatment. So in terms of steroids, you can go from Dex 10 IVQ6 up to high dose solumedrol, a gram, QD to BID of up to every QD to BID up to 3 days. The next step would be the use of anakinra, the anti-IL-1 monoclonal antibody. And if that doesn't work, remember the original lymphodepletion chemotherapy we gave for CAR T that kills T cells? You can give chemotherapy, drugs like cyclophosphamide, to really shut down the T cells. But again, at this point, the patient is likely to be admitted and being mostly managed by the oncologist. But from an ER standpoint, tocilizumab, dexamethasone, and anakinra are tools that are well within your grasp to use. ICONS has a little bit of a different pathophysiology, and that's where those T cells that we activate cross through the blood-brain barrier and are now causing alterations in sensorium, everything from a headache to a little confusion to seizure and comatose. Now, the way we evaluate this is with what we call the ICE score. So when I am on call and the nurse calls me about the patient getting a T cell engager in the middle of the night, they'll read me off the vitals and they'll say, and the ICE is 10 out of 10. The ICE score is a 10-point scoring system, including orientation, naming, following commands, writing, and attention. But the most important one of all of these is writing. So when we have patients in the hospital receiving T-cell redirection therapy, we have them write a sentence every single day while they're in the hospital. Because one of the earliest signs of development of ICONS is micrographia and dysgraphia. So if you have a patient in the ER and they're a little bit off, have them write a sentence out and evaluate it. If it's really horrible or really small, this may be indicative of ICONS. Now, we have a grading system as well, and it really follows the ICE score. And again, as you get progressive, this is something where you really want to start considering having the ICU involved. And again, it's always a difficult call in the ER when someone hits the floor. You know, this patient's a little bit confused, a little bit somnolent. I think for some disorders, you send them to a gen med floor. But if you have someone who has grade 2 or even grade 3 ICONS, this is someone who's going to need a higher level of monitoring. So just to give you an example, this was a patient of ours that developed neurotox. And on the first day, they're like, today I received my T cells. Looks great. And the second day, it's starting to look like my handwriting. Today, I can't read that at all. And as this patient was writing this, they started to have more and more confusion and ultimately develop full-on neurotoxicity. Now, here's where the question of are they having CRS with the ICONS or ICONS alone has a big impact. So it turns out that if you're having CRS and ICONS, oftentimes the first approach is going to be to either give dexamethasone or tocilizumab. However, if you are not having CRS when you have ICONS, there's no role for tocilizumab because toci does not cross the blood-brain barrier as dexamethasone does and as anakinra does. So in general, if you have either CRS with ICONS, that's for calcitrant to toci, or ICONS with no CRS, Usually the first approach is to give dexamethasone, so 10 milligrams IV times one, up to every 6 hours. And again, this is for someone who's brought in by a family member. They're told that they had a CAR T or a bispecific antibody a few weeks ago and reported some headache and is now more somnolent and has a lowered ICE score or a lower glioblastoma index, something of that nature. And here the progression is the same approach where you start slowly escalating from dexamethasone, considering high-dose solumedrol or anakinra. Again, one of the things you want to consider here is neuroimaging. And patients with really depressed ICE scores, you may want to consider anti-epileptic drugs such as Keppra because these patients can seize and you may want to get neuro and or ICU involved. This patient received anakinra and dexamethasone, and you can see their handwriting returned to normal. One of the other things that we've started to see a recrudescence of is something called hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis. I know it's a mouthful. We colloquially refer to this as HLH. This is literally where the immune system gets so activated that the macrophages start gobbling up and eating the other cells within the bone marrow. Although this was classically described as being a secondary manifestation of diseases like lymphomas and leukemias, we now recognize that the chemokine and cytokine activation of T cell activation in bispecific antibodies and CAR Ts can lead to macrophage activation, and ultimately macrophage activation leads to HLH. These are patients that come in with sky-high LFTs, ferritin that can also often be greater than 10,000, pancytopenia. These are odd presentations, but early diagnosis is key. So someone's not feeling well after a CAR T or a bispecific, a couple weeks later, they come in with a brand new pancytopenia. AST and ALT are in the several hundreds. Ferritin is in the thousands or tens of thousands. You have to be concerned about HLH. And this is where we start in mostly with high-dose dexamethasone and anakinra. If these patients don't respond to high-dose dexamethasone and anakinra, we start considering classical chemotherapeutic agents like etoposide. So ultimately, the landscape of myeloma has evolved. We've really come from, in my mind, the three great epochs of myeloma therapy. We started off in the 60s and 70s, giving classical chemotherapy drugs like alkylators and anthracyclines, where response rates were quite poor, tolerability was horrible. And then at the turn of the millennium, we really started using what we call the novel therapies, the immunomodulatory drugs, the derivatives of thalidomide, the proteasome inhibitors, and the monoclonal antibodies. But over the last few years, we've moved on to the third great epoch of T-cell redirection with bispecifics and CAR Ts. Now, these are wonderful therapies, but at the time that we're talking right now, the majority of these are being given in academic centers, and not all ERs are in academic centers. But that doesn't mean that every patient who gets it at my center lives down the block. We have patients that travel a distance to get this, may be at home and may call 911, and these patients may enter your ER even if your institution does not give these therapies. Now, CAR Ts are still going to remain in the academic centers for a long period of time, and probably forever, whereas bispecifics are slowly increasing in utilization in the community. So, the fact that these therapies are becoming much more ubiquitous, much more heavily utilized in the community, means you're going to have to start knowing what to do with these patients. You know, in RER, I see them use the term cancer fever. And cancer fever means you have a malignancy, you come in with a fever, and here at our institution, we have vancomycin. I don't know if you guys have vancomycin, and for those of you who are not familiar with this, this is the combination of vancomycin and cefepime. And it's very common that I come in when I'm on service in the morning and the residents present the case. Mrs. Jones came in last night. She had some fever. They drew cultures. They did scans and x-rays and urine. And she's on vancomycin and cefepime. And whereas that is pretty good for many of our patients, if that patient is having CRS or ICONS, they could be dead by the morning or severely impaired. So what do you do when these patients hit the ER? I think that as much information as you can gather about what therapy they're on, and specifically ask if they're getting one of these new immune therapies. They may have a card, they may have a loved one with them, but this is where I think early collaboration with the hem-onc doc is very important. I like sleep as much as the next person. And, you know, you don't have to wake me at 3 o'clock in the morning when my patient on therapy had a slip and fall and has a fractured ankle. But if there's a question, I would rather get that call at 3 a.m. to help guide therapy. In general, ICONS is going to be less common in the ER, but CRS is going to be more common. And I think when in doubt, this is where, you know, I always joke that the dermatologist has two pockets. One pocket has a steroid cream, one has the antifungal cream. When they don't know, they give both. I think the same could be true here. We do the same on the inpatient side. Someone has a fever within an hour of the drug, that's CRS. Months later, it's infection. But oftentimes we get patient a week or two in, can't tell. We draw cultures, we give 10 dex, we give broad spectrum antibiotics, and then we undergo an evaluation, including things like procalcitonin and directed evaluation like chest x-ray and urine. The next morning, the procal was 3 and the UA is positive. Yep, you don't have to give more steroid, that's infection. The next day, the patient is improving, not back to baseline, but the procal is normal and the cultures are all negative. That may have just been CRS. The multidisciplinary team is the way to go here, and it's really important to involve everyone in this. So ongoing collaborations with not just the hem-onc docs, but the APNs, the RNs, pharmacists are critical, especially when giving multiple very expensive and complex drugs, patient navigators, technicians, and unfortunately rehab specialists for patients that need it. Ultimately having the patient centered in the focus in the middle, but including also people like dietitians, because patients with the GPRC5D drugs may come in with weight loss. So having nutritional support may be absolutely critical for these patients. So, you know, I think the issue is having an index of suspicion. You know, someone comes in and they have, you know, right now these are mostly in the hematologic malignancies like leukemia, lymphoma, and myeloma. They haven't been really utilized much in solid tumors, but they're coming too. So someone comes in with a blood cancer, ask or inquire or see if the EMR has any information about what drug they're on. If that drug ends in a MAB, ask, see if you can get more information, because most of these are some type of antibody drugs and end in MAB, and a lot of them will have brand new side effects that we haven't seen in a generation gone by. Calling consultants early, and this is multifaceted. This is taking someone who's more somnolent and not just say, hey, give them some fluid and observe them. You may need neurology for assessment of need for anti-epileptic therapy. We may need early ICU monitoring. And I know in most institutions, the board to be above for ICU admission is pressor support or ventilatory support. But oftentimes these patients can become quite ill quite fast. And we have agreements with our ICU that anyone with advancing ICONS, even if they're not on pressors or ventilatory support, can go to the ICU for more aggressive monitoring. Calling the hem-onc doc who may be treating the patient earlier on to get an assessment of what is more likely in this scenario, overwhelming infection, CRS, ICONS, could it be all three? We have had patients with all three that need therapy for all three, and ongoing labs and imaging to help narrow down, is this fever and tachycardia sepsis or is it CRS or can we not tell at the current moment? And with that, I will thank everyone very kindly for listening and take any questions, concerns, complaints, or comments.
Thank you so much, Dr. Richter. At this time, we are happy to take any questions that you may have.
Hi, I was just wondering, what is the difference between the ICE score and the CAR tox?
So the CAR tox is really a general assessment for, I believe CAR tox is more infection. That's evaluating the risk of infection with a CAR T. And that's kind of predictive values of what may happen during the CAR T. The ICE score is really when you think they're having ICONS itself. So someone who's already received the CAR T or maybe having a headache or confusion, that's where we really use the ICE score.
And another question coming up.
Are there any negative implications for giving antibiotics to these patients who are having cytokine release?
That's a really phenomenal question. And the answer is no. And I think that's really our approach, is that and both sides of the equation. So there's no harm in giving them antibiotics, obviously without the, you know, the general risk of antibiotics with allergic reactions or rashes or infection or resistance, but there's no harm in shooting first and asking questions later for both antibiotics and steroids. You know, I think we also, for a while, there are two reasons we were worried about steroids in these patients. One, we're worried if they have overwhelming infection, will we further harm their immune system by giving steroids? And the answer is no, you're not. The other is that we used to be very scared about giving steroids, especially to CAR T patients, because steroids kill T cells. And the worry was always, oh my God, if you have a CAR T that cost $500,000 to manufacture and is this person's only hope at fighting their cancer, and you give steroids, you could kill the CART. It turns out that with Tenodex, you're not going to kill the CART. And for bispecific antibodies, if for some reason you did harm the T cells, which you're not going to, you can get another dose in a few weeks. So no issues giving either, which is why, you know, I think in a realm where most ERs are not going to have easy access to tocilizumab, giving steroids and antibiotics is a great first approach for patients where you can't figure it out.
With that, I would like to thank you, Dr. Richter, for your time, your teaching and expertise this evening.